For the week of December 6th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 32, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And eating tiramisu in a grocery store in beautiful downtown Long Island City, Queens, New York, I'm Michael Gills.
And what you were just listening to was the Grammy-nominated band, MGMT. They were nominated for Grammys this week. I know we're going to be talking about the Grammys a little later on the show, but they were nominated for Best New Artist. And Kids, which opens our show each week, was nominated for Best Pop Performance by a Duo or Group. They will be going up
with
against...
With vocals.
They're going to be going up against John Hall, John Oates, and Hall & Oates.
Daryl Hall and John Oates.
Thank you.
Hello. You're not a child of the 80s.
I could remember. It was one of those little brain moments that I... But I was very happy to see that they were nominated for a Grammy, even though it seems like they should have been nominated, like, last year.
But, you know, MGMT, they... I think they have a good shot. There's no clear frontrunner for Best New Artist, so they have as good a shot as anyone in that category.
And if you want to hear even more of their music, you can go to their MySpace page, myspace.com/MGMT, or their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, I got that little plug out of the way, so we won't have to do it at the end of the show. But during this show, we will be talking to David Weil, the contributing editor for Rolling Stone, about the Grammy Awards. He also helped write the Grammy Awards nomination telecast. He's also writing the Grammy Awards, which will air January 31st. We will also be talking to Eugene Hernandez, who is the founder and editor of IndieWire.com, and he will be with us to talk about not only the Spirit Award nominations, which were announced last week, but also the official selection of the Sundance Film Festival for 2010. First, as always, we will begin, though, with Michael's take on the box office.
Well, for the third week in a row, no surprise, the biggest news at the box office is The Blind Side, starring Sandra Bullock. It was the number one movie of the week. It grossed $20 million, or more than $20 million, for the third week in a row. It's at a total of $130 million. It's one of the best grossing sports films of all time. Sandra Bullock is the biggest female box office star in the world right now. Number two is The Twilight Saga New Moon, which made $15 million and is at $255 million in the U.S. alone. Brothers is the Jake Gyllenhaal, Tobey Maguire, My Personal Dream Team drama, which grossed $9.7 million, a little soft, but it's a serious drama, so that's not surprising. A Christmas Carol is starting to fall away a bit and made $7.5 million for a total of $115 million. Old Dogs fell again dramatically, $6.9 million. It's already at $33 million and looks like it's almost done. Armored is a heist film that sort of barely opened at $6.6 million. 2012 made $6.6 million. It's at almost $150 million. Ninja Assassin made $5 million. Planet 51 made $4 million. And Everybody's Fine, the Robert De Niro film, which was being touted for him as a best actor possibility, didn't open. It collapsed. It made $4 million, even though it opened on more than 2,000 screens. It's a very weak opening. And given that the reviews were mixed and the movie isn't a commercial hit, his chances of a best actor nomination are probably gone. And Fantastic Mr. Fox made $2.8 million. And then Precious dropped pretty big after the Thanksgiving weekend. It made $2.3 million, which again would be a pretty darn good opening weekend for a movie of this size and with this cast. But its total gross is $36 million after 5 weeks at the box office. And a limited release, two big movies to look at are Up in the Air, which had a tremendous opening weekend. It made $1.1 million on only 15 screens. That's almost an $80,000 per screen average. And The Princess and the Frog made $744,000, even though it's only on two screens. It's doing very well in limited release, but I have something to say about that.
Go ahead.
Can I keep? I figured out how The Princess and the – last week, Princess and the Frog, it grossed $370,000 or something per screen. And it was just like, what the – how did it do that? Oh, my God. I've never seen numbers like that.
Oh, well, I know where you're going with this. I know where you're going
with
this.
Yeah, I went to the Ziegfeld to see it at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, and the lovely lady said, that'll be $30 for your ticket, sir.
Yep, that's
right. I had no idea.
What?
The general admission price for the first 2 weeks is $30, or if you want the royal package, it's $50, and you get to take your tyke to a little the Roseland Ballroom here in New York City that they've redone as a bayou, a New Orleans bayou, and you can play around in there for an hour or two after the movie and, you know, like, play in the setting of the film. But $30 or $50, I am far less impressed by the opening for this movie than I was 2 weeks ago. So they're getting people to pay it, so more power to them. But come December 13th, the movie will be at regular prices, and we can see how it actually does on wide release.
Well, Michael, you really hit on all the fine points. I mean, I really feel like I could have used last week's box office audio and just cut it into this week, especially about The Blind Side and Sandra Bullock being the number one female movie star of this year and right now. The film is doing phenomenally well. I mean, I want to see it at this point. Twilight Saga just plummeted 63% over last weekend. So that film is just, it just is falling off the face of the earth.
And well, it's already made $255 million, though. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, everyone
it's made
saw
tons
it already.
Of money.
That's where I was headed with that. Yeah, $255 million is nothing to sneeze at by its third week. It certainly is a big bang type of movie. That movie's not going to have legs. And Precious seems to, you know, have kind of played out its stay. It's in 12th place. It's dropped 67%. Although, remember, Thanksgiving weekend is usually higher than the weekend after Thanksgiving. Was glad to see Up in the Air do well.
And get picked by the National Board of Review as the best film of the year.
That's right. I knew I was forgetting to mention something there. But now, just going back to Twilight for just a moment, because I know we haven't talked enough about that film. Did you read this post on moviephone.com about the five directors who could tackle the Twilight saga Breaking Dawn? This is the next Twilight movie.
I read it, but, you know, I think that you're coming at it from a perspective that I don't think was intended. I think that the writer, that was his dream list. I don't think it was people who might actually be up for it. Read the list.
None of these people are going to do it. First off, we have Tim Burton. Absolutely no way. Could maybe.
No, but you can understand why the writer thought that Tim Burton would make an interesting version of Twilight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Catherine Hardwicke is the second person, a second filmmaker that this writer is suggesting. And of course, she directed the first Twilight and then, you know, there was some
controversy. Was fired.
Yeah, there was some controversy yeah. over whether she was fired or she walked away from New Moon. Peter Jackson, who is apparently not busy enough co-directing a film with Steven Spielberg and working on The Hobbit, so he apparently should consider directing Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn. Quentin Tarantino, because apparently these Twilight films, they're just not long enough and they don't have enough dialogue. So we really need more dialogue and longer scenes. And Len Wiseman, who is known for, I guess, Underworld. Now he out of everybody, he's the one that I think could probably potentially direct this thing.
He's such a hack.
Well, Karen's right, though. This is not an industry story. This is just a story on Movie Phone about, oh, what would it be like if Peter Jackson or Quentin Tarantino or Tim Burton directed the next movie? But everybody knows that Chris Weitz is going to direct it. I mean, he's finally launched a franchise, and he's gonna do it.
Yeah, that's probably
true. I don't think so, actually. They got David Slade to do the third one. I think that they will probably kind of James Bond this and get somebody else entirely to do the fourth.
Maybe they could James Bond it and make a good movie.
Yeah, no, he's not doing the third.
Oh, I'm sorry. I stand corrected.
Well, now, we could stick with movies, or we could switch things up and start talking about music and give David Wilde, the contributing editor of Rolling Stone, a call and go over all the Grammy nominations. Why don't we do that, actually?
All right.
Sounds great. Switching things up a little bit. Let me just dial him up here. We're going to be calling him on the phone. Okay. Joining us now by phone from Los Angeles is David Wilde, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. You also write for the Huffington Post, and you wrote the Grammy Award nominations one-hour special.
Yes, I wrote half of George Lopez's joke. So yes, I guess so. I'm technically the writer.
He only had one joke?
Actually, he had three, and I wrote one and a half. And he added a Tiger Woods joke that I could never have gotten away with.
Yeah, I remember that. And it kind of, it didn't go over as well as he had hoped, it looked like.
No, well, he just slipped it into the nominations themselves. He claimed that Use Somebody by Kings of Leon was, although I believe he said Kings of Leon, was written by Tiger Woods. That was his addition.
Well, now we should also say you can be found on Twitter. Wild About Music is your Twitter handle. And
yes, that's true.
Your book is still available at fine retailers and online. He is, I say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond. It's actually a great book. I bought it for two people this Christmas, and I don't know why I just said that, since they now probably know what they're getting.
It is the perfect Jewish stocking stuffer. So if you have a Jewish stocking, a circumcised stocking, then definitely it would fit. It's in paperback, so it's smaller, which fits Jewish stockings better, I think.
Right. Now, besides writing for the Grammys, it seems like you are at another award show every other week. I'm constantly reading on your Twitter feed you're talking to somebody at the Country Music Awards, or you're talking to somebody at the AMAs, or it always seems that you have a much more exciting life than any of us.
I'm glad that it seems exciting to someone else. It is occasionally very exciting to me, but it does involve there was a run in the recent weeks where I think it was right from the Emmys to the Scream Awards to the CMAs to the Academy Award Governors Awards, which, by the way, there was one day when I think it was a good tweet day because I was interviewing Ringo Starr for a little documentary thing and had to say the following phrase: "Sorry, Ringo, I have to leave. I have to go talk to Lauren Bacall," which I said, this is I do like my life when I can. And then, you know, if you're a name dropper, I have a good life as a name dropper. I'm not sure in terms of earning potential, but I do well in the name dropping.
You've been writing for the Grammys for some time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think at least a decade now, yes.
Well, how did this year's nomination stack up against previous year's nominations? Certainly, if you read all the critics in the newspapers and online, they seem to think that there were very few surprises in this year's Grammy nominations.
You know, I have a weird attitude. Ironically, for a guy who spends his time around a lot of award shows, I have never spent that much time thinking about the nominations. I think a lot about the show and how to make the show work, but it's almost like there was one person who I desperately wanted nominated, a new artist who I loved, and she wasn't nominated, and I was heartbroken. But beyond that, it's very pragmatic to me. It's just who's nominated, and then we sit down, and I went to a meeting the next day. You know, the Grammys, the sort of television committee sits down with the guy, Neil Portnow, who runs NARIS, and Ken Ehrlich, and John Cosette, who are sort of, you know, the executive producers of the TV show, and we all spend like 4 hours just trying to pour through the nominations to try to make the best show possible. But the nominations themselves, I've never thought much about because I'm always so self-obsessed with my own taste that I don't really care about anyone else's taste.
Who was the new artist that you were rooting for?
Oh, it was a woman named Diane Birch, who to me is just one of the most appealing singer-songwriters in a decade. I love her. I tweet with her. I blog about her. I'll do anything I can to help her become a star. And I was hoping she would get a Best New Artist nomination.
Well, the people who did get nominations this year for Song of the Year, Beyoncé Knowles for Single Ladies, or as my youngest daughter likes to say, Singing Lettuce. Lady Gaga for Poker Face. Maxwell for Pretty Wings. Kings of Leon for You Somebody, which makes a great Tiger Woods joke if you're George Lopez. Taylor Swift for You Belong With Me. And actually, it really seemed to be the Beyoncé Knowles and Taylor Swift show. Beyoncé was nominated for 10 awards, and Taylor Swift nabbed 8.
Yeah, you know, the Taylor Swift effect is one that I embrace. I know I do the CMAs, which is the country music's biggest night. It's sort of the Grammys of country. And Taylor Swift, single-handedly, I'm convinced, made our show a smash this year because she really is, she crosses every, you know, all boundaries. And even the people like who are, even in hip hop, she's now world famous simply because, you know, they know she was the one who Kanye Trouble, you know, made cry.
I just wish she could sing on key.
Ouch.
She's a terrible live performer. She really is. God bless her for having her. She's writing her own songs, but every time I see her perform, I don't see how she's going to last 20 years because she's just not a good performer.
Well, to be slightly more diplomatic, I am a huge fan of her as a writer. I think she is an incredible, for a young person, she's a really talented songwriter. And her singing, you know, no, she's no Beyonce, she's no Christina Aguilera, but we will see. You know, I mean, have you heard the Bob Dylan Christmas record? You can actually have quite a long career without being able to sing.
Bob Dylan's a great singer, actually. He's one of the great singers of all time.
I agree, though. I think he's sort of a whiner. Was it Winona Judd who said that Taylor Swift didn't deserve the Entertainer of the Year at the CMAs because she was too young?
She said it apparently right afterwards. She didn't say it during the show. But yeah, she was quickly quoted and she quickly then sort of took it back. But no, listen, she's a phenomena. And, you know, when I don't, just because some group votes someone best new artist, you know, as we've just heard, you don't have to embrace that, but it is a sort of, you know, it's just sort of a snapshot of where music is at any given time. And right now we seem to be women. That's the thing that's sort of most interesting to me of the nominations, is that it is sort of the, you know, the year of the woman in terms of nominations.
That's very true. You know, Lady Gaga did not get a Best New Artist nomination, but that's because she was...
She wasn't eligible.
Right, she wasn't eligible. She was nominated for a Grammy last year. She did pick up 3 nominations for this year's awards. Also picking up nominations were the Black Eyed Peas, Maxwell, and Kanye West. So that should be interesting with Kanye West and Taylor Swift at the same show, an award show no less.
Listen, Kanye West has made my year so much more profitable. It's like he gave me the best joke I wrote at the Emmys. He gave me the best jokes for the CMAs. He just kept giving. I embrace. I want Kanye West never to go away because he makes life very interesting for writers.
Well, maybe you can explain to me what the difference is between Album of the Year, and this year nominated is Beyonce for I Am Sasha Fierce, Black Eyed Peas, The END is their record, Lady Gaga for The Fame, Taylor Swift for Fearless, and a surprise, Dave Matthews Band for Big Whiskey and the Gru Grux King. And then what is the difference between Album of the Year and Record of the Year? Now, Record of the Year, nominated in that category this year, Beyonce for Halo, Black Eyed Peas for I Got a Feeling, Kings of Leon for You Somebody, Lady Gaga for Poker Face, and Taylor Swift for You Belong With Me. Now, to me, an album is a record, and a record is an album.
Now, a record refers to a particular single or a particular tune that was recorded. An Album of the Year is the entire body of work. Album is like equivalent to LP or CD. Record of the Year is paired with Song of the Year. Record of the Year is for the actual tune that the person recorded, whereas Song of the Year is a reward for the songwriting. So the implication is that if you've written the Song of the Year, you might have written like a great tune that a lot of people will cover, but maybe your Record of the Year is something like, say, Outkast's Hey Ya, which is a great single, but you don't necessarily want to hear a lot of people do a cover of it. It's not a tune that necessarily lends itself to covers. So a Record of the Year is for that particular production, that particular recording, whereas Song of the Year is like, oh, you've written a standard, and people will record that song. A lot of different artists in different genres might record that for years to come. That's the idea behind Song of the Year versus Record of the Year.
Can I just say that I wrote the Grammy official 50th anniversary book, and there's no way in hell I could ever have given one-third of the insightful explanation that you just heard. That was beautifully said.
Wow.
Well, thank you, but I wanted to ask you the question because I was confused, because I think Beyonce's Single Ladies Put a Ring on It is one of the great records. It's a great record, but it's absolutely not a Song of the Year. It should be for Record of the Year, and in fact, she got Halo for Record of the Year and Single Ladies for Song of the Year. It seems a little backwards to me there.
It's not as backwards as Toto winning like all of those awards years ago, so we're making progress. I understand. I actually see your point, but... again, I actually don't even vote. I am not a member of NARIS. I don't vote, so I can't justify any of that. I think it is unbelievably complicated. It's sort of like the hanging chads. There's a lot of room for error in this election process, but you know, and it's also infinitely complicated by the number of categories. You know, I think what did we reveal on the TV show last week? We revealed like 7 or 6 of the categories. I think there's 125 categories or something like that. You know, the Grammys sort of pushed this earlier, the idea of it's not all about the awards, it's also about really a performance show. And I have to say, doing a lot of different shows, that does seem to be the movement. I mean, the show I wrote for the Motion Picture Academy, the Governor's Awards, that was a matter of they took some of the awards that were traditionally on the show and did an event, and they'll film some of that and feature that on the show. The Emmys, I know that they battled with they went up against the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild for just trying to pre-tape a half an hour early some of those awards to get more time on for other entertainment. And I think as the TV landscape changes, all these award shows are basically trying to find ways to de-emphasize the awards, because that's not generally what gets the ratings as much as, you know, other sorts of entertainment.
Well, with the Grammys, it seems that, to me, I mean, I'm looking at the Best New Artist category, and you have Zac Brown, Carrie Hilson, MGMT, who provides our theme music, the Silver Sun Pickups, and the Ting Tings. Now, the Ting Tings are a great band, but the Silver Sun Pickups, I mean, I saw them at Coachella years ago, in 2007, I want to say. So how are they Best New Artist?
You know, the qualification, I think it's like, as you were saying with Lady Gaga, it has more to do with have you been recognized before than it has to do with, you know, because I think it does. Listen, these issues, you can say, and your point is well taken. I actually happen to like this, like the band, but the point is, like, in the world of bands that might do four indie things that are under the radar and then something that gets attention, I don't know when you stop being a new artist. And I think the Grammys determines it by when, if you've been recognized once, you're no longer a new artist.
Well, I was sorry that Maxwell didn't get up for Album of the Year, and I was hoping maybe Neil Diamond for Hot August Nights might get a Best Pop Vocal nomination. But what are you happiest about seeing? What was your favorite, one of your favorite nominations that you saw on the list this year?
Boy, I'm such an unhappy guy. I can't come up with anything that made me especially happy. It's more, I have to say, maybe this is my own orientation in life. For the TV show, it's more we're thinking about what could go wrong. Like, I mean, I personally am happy, despite what I was sort of jokingly saying, Bob Dylan's one of my favorite artists, so I'm happy when I see Bob Dylan's name. I'm happy when I see, I'm from New Jersey, so I'm happy to see Bruce Springsteen's name. But nothing, I was happy this year because I think for the success of the show, there were a lot of exciting opportunities. Like having Kanye and Taylor both nominated, that certainly creates some excitement.
Yeah, you were thrilled
about
that.
And I happen to like both of them.
Well, and for me, it's like the rock category is always such a old fogey category. I mean, it's just Bob Dylan, John Fogerty, Prince, Bruce Springsteen, and Neil Young, with only maybe Bob Dylan worthy for this year for their. I mean, it's just such a bring out the old guys award. They sometimes seem to be on cruise control.
I heard there was a lot of criticism this year for Hall & Oates being nominated, but personally, I'm the biggest Sarah Smile fan, so I can live with Sarah Smile being nominated every year.
Yeah, they deserve it because they had their first retrospective box set and they had that live album, so it's totally noteworthy, as opposed to sort of the road every year, James Taylor, every year, you know, Bob Dylan, et cetera. But I did want to ask you a general question about the Grammys. I've always felt that they're too, the performance, the show in January is too early in the year, that it should be in like March or April, and they should have it be just the category, the year of music. You know, January to December, because when they hold it in January, that means only albums through August or September are eligible. So we have all the big fall releases and none of them are on the Grammy Awards. So it gets very confusing. People, it always feels like it's a year behind.
That's interesting. You know, I've heard people wanting it the other way. I've heard people wanting it in December so that it, but I actually haven't heard people wanting it later. It's way above my pay grade, but I will report that to people who actually have any power whatsoever. And I'll try to get back to you. But that's, I do see that point, that it's, that cutoff date is always frustrating because, but by the way, just because people aren't nominated, generally we have found ways to work other great notable artists into the show almost every year. So I think the show actually does end up reflecting a lot of those people. It's just in the nominations, there's some time lag just to, you know, to make sure the voting is done in a real way, because I think unlike other shows, unlike, you know, other major music award shows, it's a legit operation where they actually try to have rules and follow them. And I think we all know there's a lot of TV shows where it's, you know, the award goes to whoever shows up.
Well, to your point, Michael, I mean, if you look at best pop performance by a duo or group with vocals, you have MGMT for Kids, the song that opens our show each week. And it's a great song, but that was a very big song in 2008, not 2009. And
right. It always creates trouble.
Now, David, what did you think about Nick Jonas's performance? He performed with a new band, not his brothers, I don't know what their names are, the other Jonas brothers.
Would be Kevin and anybody, third Jonas brother.
Don't forget the bonus, Jonas.
Zeppo.
The Administration is his new band, or his backing band. What did people think of that? What did you think of his performance on your Grammy nomination special?
You know, I was backstage running around. I watched rehearsal, which was quite good. My only memory of the actual on-air performance was that there was a couple little technical little feedback moments, which is never pleasant on live television, but usually kind of inevitable. The best part for me was afterwards, I walked past his dressing room, which was next to my office, and the two guys who were from Prince's band screamed out my name because they remembered me from hanging out in Paris like 12 years ago. So that was that made me feel very cool for, and I don't usually feel that cool. That was a cool moment. But I thought, you know, I thought it was very pleasant. It sounded sort of like his attempt to sort of, you know, go into the John Mayerville. Maybe that was my overwhelming sense of it.
By the way, it's Joe Jonas, Kevin, yes. Nick, and Joe Jonas, and then the bonus Jonas.
Frankie.
Well, as far as the big award shows, I don't count all the silly little ones, but if you look at the Oscars and the Grammys and the Emmys appears right when the fall season begins, so they're dealing with the previous year. And the Oscars does it in March so that they include all the Christmas shows. The Tonys does it in the summer when the season ends so that they're able to include shows up until the last minute. That's a little easier for them. There's so many albums that get released. It's hard for – they've got to have a 3-month lag for people to actually listen to the albums, vote on them, go through the whole process. But either if they had it in August or September before the fall music season or in March so they could include the Christmas stuff, I think it would make a lot more sense. So just pass that on.
I will be glad to do that. You know what? In fact, I'm going to call while you're hold. If you go on hold, I'll try to get the show pushed to March right now. That shouldn't be a problem.
Apparently, David is quite busy in January and needs to rearrange the Grammy schedule to suit his busy work schedule. What do you have coming up? You're obviously the Grammys, but is there anything else you're working on?
I'm actually working on a documentary. I have to fly to New York tomorrow. For that, I do a couple smaller shows and sort of one sort of community-oriented project. I have a couple big documentary, sort of bigger projects that I'm trying to focus on most of December. And then I've received two emails from Ken Ehrlich, who runs the, you know, Grammy production, working on different concepts for the show today. So it gets a little quiet, you know, now, and I'm looking forward to a little more quiet.
Well, David, thank you very much for joining us to talk about the Grammy nominations today.
Sure.
Certainly, we look forward to keeping in touch with you and seeing how the Grammys pan out in January.
Great. I'll talk to you then, I hope.
Certainly, and we should point again everybody to your Twitter posts at twitter.com/wildaboutmusic, as well as your book, He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond. And, of course, you can always be found on the Huffington Post.
And remember, every award should go to Neil Diamond. That's my conservative
theory.
Nobel Peace Prize. If not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, let's go right to the Nobel Peace Prize.
He'll have to fight Obama, won't he?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Well, it was nice of David to take the time to talk to us. He seems to work on every award show in the country, practically.
I know. I didn't want to really get into – I know his time was limited, and I didn't really want to get into it. But it seems like he must be writing every single award show. I'm going to ask if he writes the Oscars. It seems like he must.
How does one get a gig like that?
I'd like him to – if he needs an assistant, tell him I'm available.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we should probably move directly from music. You know what? Let's stay with music for a bit. You know, because there's something I wanted to kind of mention about some music news that was made this week that's really kind of music and technology news. Have any of you ever used this social networking music site called Lala?
Nope.
I've seen people use it, but I've never been on it.
Well, a couple years back, about 4 years ago, they launched as a way to swap CDs. So you could find another user's CD that you want and then send them one of yours. They send you the one you want. And then it quickly turned into a way to share streaming music online, which the record companies absolutely loved. Not. And what happened is Warner Music Group invested $20 million in them. And then earlier this year took an $11 million write-down from its investment, saying, you know, that's it. They're getting out of this internet stuff, and it just didn't seem like it was going to really work out for Lala. I signed up for it last week and started playing around with it. And what it allows is for a user like myself to upload their entire catalog if it's not already on Lala. So it searched my hard drive and my external hard drive for all of the music that I had, 12,000 songs, and it then said, okay, we have these 7,000 songs, so we don't need to upload these, but we don't have these 5,000. We're going to upload them. Now they're up in the cloud on the internet, and you can always come to Lala on your iPhone. There's an iPhone app, or on a web browser, and listen to any one of these songs. As well, you can search for any song you want, and you can listen to it. And most of the songs that I searched for were there. Now, you can listen to it once. Then, after the first time, you get a 30-second clip from it. You can queue up and make playlists of entire albums. You can buy a web version of the song so that you can listen to it over and over again online or on your iPhone for 10 cents. You can buy the song for anywhere from 69 to 89 or 99 cents. It's kind of interesting. And the reason I looked it up is because, of course, they had a couple of weeks ago this new deal with Google where they were joining some new search offering for music that Google had created. And then, lo and behold, I sent out a post about it on Friday night on Twitter, and I get all of these responses back about how Apple came in and bought Lala. So that was a right. long-winded way of getting to that point. But
it sounds sort of interesting that it's you know, you can access, instead of having to put your music on your iPod or your iPhone, if you have a lot of it, you can put it in the cloud and then access it any number of ways. For most people, though, of course, they probably can fit all their songs on any decent-sized iPod. So I'm not sure it'll necessarily take it, but it's a nice adjunct. It would be a nice adjunct to your iTunes service or something that they would offer. But to have to pay, how much do you pay a month to be able to access your music?
Nothing. Not a thing.
They, for free, will host all your music and let you access it anywhere at any time for free?
Yes.
So why is Apple doing it?
Well, I think they're looking at services like Pandora, like Spotify, and they're beginning to see that the streaming music subscription phenomenon, whatever you want to call it, is actually going to encroach on iTunes. And so what they really need is iTunes, a streaming version of iTunes.
Yeah, they're doing what Google does. They're not reinventing the wheel. They're buying it.
Right, exactly. And really, they're buying the engineers. I mean,
that's interesting.
You know, the engineers who behind Lala were actually very good.
Yeah, it streams your own stuff. It seems like a nice little adjunct, but it's not anything game-changing or like, oh, wow, you know, you have to have a music library of music. If you do, it's sort of helpful.
Yes. Well, David
Gold. But that's what you'll notice, that's kind of what Google does too, is that they buy stuff that you're like, you know, the average person doesn't really pay that much attention to. And then all of a sudden, boom, they have it
right when
they need it.
Certainly Spotify, which is a European company, is bound to come to the United States sometime early next year. I think what you're also going to see is a whole bunch of services that are known as digital lockers, so that you can upload your content or just buy your content and leave it online. And no matter where you go, whether it's on your iPhone or another person's computer or your television set, it's just always in the cloud and it will just stream to wherever you are and wherever you want it. And as David Goldberg, the former general manager of Yahoo Music, said, I am sure Apple is watching streaming music, the traction of Pandora, of course, and other streaming applications on the iPhone. There's a legitimate question here. Why should people have to download music?
See, a lot of these new technology things, like, actually they work, but the problem is getting it to a tipping point where everybody's using it.
How many buzzwords can we use in this podcast? Tipping point.
I think it's a question of needing an audience for it. Again, most people can fit every damn CD they own onto an iPod. They don't need to put it in the clouds. I have a gig of music. I have a gig and a half of music. I need to. That would be useful for me. But for my brother and 99% of the people I know, their medium-sized iPhone or iPod can hold every damn song they own, and that's not going to change.
That term, digital locker, is going to be something you are going to hear more and more over the next few years.
Security is the future, and I don't feel secure with other people having access to all my information. I'm not putting my stuff on the cloud anytime
soon. Let me tell you, they have it now. Trust me, they have it now.
We could talk about this all day long because, as you know, it's a favorite topic of mine. But we have to call Eugene Hernandez over at IndieWire to talk about the Spirit Awards and the official selection of the 2010 Sundance Film Festival. So let me just, we're going to be reaching him on Skype. And I think he said he did or didn't have a headset. We'll find out. Hold on just a second here. Well, I am happy to say that joining us now via Skype from New York City is Eugene Hernandez, the founder and editor of IndieWire. I'm sure everyone listening to this has been to IndieWire. Eugene is so well known that I was reading Facebook last night, or maybe it was Twitter, and I saw that Mike, you ran into Michael Stipe, and he was actually calling your name rather than the other way around, which I thought was very funny.
He was with Courtney Love, which I found very fascinating as well.
Yeah, they're very good friends, apparently.
They are, yeah. I think he was friends with Kurt Cobain and then became friends with her as well.
Exactly.
In that era.
Well, you can find Eugene's writing on not only IndieWire, but of course he's on Twitter. You can look his username up. It is EUG. Now, Eugene is joining us today to talk about the Spirit Award nominees, which were announced, I guess, in the middle of last week. What did you think of this year's nominees?
I think that, you know, there's always such a wide range of films eligible for the awards that I'm never totally surprised. Although in any given year, there are any number of different directions that the committees could go. I noted that The Last Station did really well, and I think that caught some folks by surprise. I haven't actually seen the film. I missed it in Telluride this year. But the inclusion of that film, I think, surprised a few people. Speaking personally, I mean, I think it's a relatively broad representative list. And again, you know, it could have gone any direction. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised to see a film like Sugar included, and it wasn't. You know, you just never know which direction the committee will go. But I think that the definition of independent is so broad right now, is what I'm trying to say. And I think that as a result, it can go in any different direction when you get in the room with the committee. And I've served on the committees in recent years, on the documentary committee specifically. And, you know, you have so many films.
Yes. Well, this year the committee decided for Best Feature to nominate 500 Days of Summer, Amrika, which was produced by Paul Barkin and Christina Piavesan. I probably should not go through the producers because I'm going to botch their
names. Don't bother with that.
Yeah. Precious. And I was very happy to see that Sin Nombre was nominated, a film that I really liked that was in Sundance last year. And of course, as you mentioned, The Last Station. In a poll that IndieWire conducted, it seems that Precious, directed by Lee Daniels, is far and away the favorite film here.
You know, the poll that we've been running since last week has Precious in the lead, but I'm not totally surprised by that. I mean, I don't know if you are, but you know, there's a feeling among industry observers that the film with the highest box office tends to be the one to have the best chance of winning, especially in the best feature category. So, you know, I'm not totally surprised simply because it's received so much attention.
Right, and I think my comment on IndieWire said, you know, I really liked Sin Nombre by Cary Fukunaga, but I really think Precious will probably win that category. I also liked 500 Days of Summer, which was directed by Mark Webb. Actually, Cary Fukunaga, I'm seeing here, for Sin Nombre, was nominated for Best Director, along with Lee Daniels for Precious, James Gray for Two Lovers, Michael Hoffman for The Last Station, and Ethan and Joel Coen for A Serious Man, because they just don't have enough awards already.
Well, I saw The Last Station just yesterday, so I have to admit I'm a little surprised it's on the list too. But as far as defining an indie film, is it now, Eugene, is it just, it's like porn, you know it when you see it? Is it impossible to define any reasonable way?
Well, you know, that's a definition I've been using for a while. I think it is. I mean, I think that, and especially in the case of the Spirit Awards, you know, they're defining it really broadly. They're defining it on where the financing is coming from, but also on the level of financing, and having that, you know, budget cap set high allows you to include a lot of movies in there. And that's a pretty controversial way to look at it. You know, we at IndieWire, we tend to go much broader because I think that we like to include a broader range of work, including work that comes from the festivals and maybe higher profile. There's no real easy way to define it unless you want to define it very, very narrowly and to include, you know, films that are only being released outside of the traditional distribution system. And I think it's going to be harder in the future to define it because, you know, distribution is changing. We're constantly challenged to try to come up with a better definition, and we end up kind of defaulting to what you just said. I think it's when you know it when you see it, and you either feel like it has an independent spirit or vibe or it doesn't, you know.
Well, it's the 25th anniversary of the Spirit Awards, which will be held during a time when it's been a rather difficult year for independent films. And you have a number of really good posts this week on the future of not only independent cinema, but film festivals. It seems that a lot of these films come from film festivals. I'm looking at Best Documentary here, and Anvil, I saw a couple years ago at Sundance, as did we all. More Than a Game, I think, was also at a film festival that I attended. What do you think the future of film festivals is? In a nutshell, I know that that's kind of hard to answer in one sentence or two sentences.
I think as distribution changes for films, I think film festivals are going to become increasingly important. And I think you're going to see festivals playing an even more active role in the distribution of films themselves, whether that be as the specific distributors in the case of some festivals or as launching pads into distribution. I think you'll see in the future films going into distribution directly out of a festival rather than waiting. You know, in the old days, which is not so many years ago, films would wait and go to a festival, try to get acquired by a distributor, and then they'd be released in theaters 6 to 12 months later. That's changing, and I think in the future you'll see, instead of 6 to 12 months, you'll see, you know, within maybe even 6 to 12 days, a film coming from a festival and right into some sort of distribution, whether that be a theatrical, digital, VOD, DVD. It's where it's going right now.
Well, certainly there are a ton of nominees to talk about when it comes to the Spirit Awards, but since we're talking about festivals, we should probably mention that you also covered this week the announcement of next year's Sundance Film Festival official selection. And what's interesting about this is that the former head of the Sundance Film Festival, Jeffrey Gilmore, resigned last year, and he's taking over the Tribeca Film Festival, and John Cooper and Trevor Goff were promoted to take over as festival directors for this year, or at least as festival programmers for this year. What is your opinion of what was selected, or what are you looking forward to?
Well, first off, you're absolutely right. There's been a significant change over the past year, with Gilmore leaving, Cooper taking his role, and then Groff taking Cooper's role. And Cooper and Trevor are clearly trying to make their mark and trying to signal that this year is going to be different. That's what they're saying. That's what they're showing in the work that they're selecting, and that's what they're really focused on. We'll know for sure when we see the films themselves, because we haven't seen a lot of these films, or most of them. What I find interesting on a personal note is the next section, which is only 8 films, but it's 8 movies that are lower budget and that are coming from generally emerging filmmakers, folks that are new to the scene, made for less money. They're the kinds of movies that might typically play at like a South by Southwest, or more specifically at CineVegas, which is a festival that Trevor Groff used to run and founded 11 years ago, and that festival just recently went out of business. So it's a place where Sundance can showcase even smaller movies. I think that over the course of the past decade, they got really, really big, as we've all seen, became much bigger showcase for celebrities, and in many cases, the focus on some of the smaller films was kind of lost. And I think they're trying to recapture that in some fashion. How easy or hard that will be remains to be seen, and we'll all find out together this year or next month.
Indeed, you quote John Cooper as saying he wants Sundance to be a filter for people to come and find the best of independent film. And he also went on to say the changing face of America, the diversity that is America, is what he was trying to capture with this year's selection. Is there any specific official selection, whether it be in the premiere section or the documentary section, that you're particularly looking forward to seeing?
Well, I mean, personally speaking, I do tend to gravitate towards the doc section. My personal interest is more on the documentary side. You know, I think I'm very curious about the Stanley Nelson film about civil rights activists. I'm particularly curious about the Joan Rivers film from Ricky and Annie, who have a track record making generally more serious films and more politically charged and heavy films. It's a different direction. Not that Joan Rivers isn't a weighty international topic, but I think they'll probably handle it in a different way.
And that's we should say that's Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, directed by Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg.
I'm also really curious, just to throw one more title at you, because I've seen some footage from this film maybe a year ago. It's called The Oath by Laura Poitras, and she's a really terrific documentary filmmaker. She made Flag Wars a couple years ago. This film, which looks at Afghanistan and 9/11, has some really compelling footage and some really compelling interviews that I think are really going to shake people, because it's a really provocative topic, and she has access to really interesting folks. And I would encourage you to keep an eye on that one. I think it's one that people will probably be talking about.
I would say that Sundance is one of the premier festivals in the U.S. to see documentaries at, kind of like the, I'm forgetting the one you just went to in Amsterdam, the international documentary.
IDFA.
Yeah.
Yeah. IDFA, the documentary festival in Amsterdam, is widely considered the most important of the international festivals, but I think you're absolutely right. I think if you're looking at American film festivals and including documentary festivals, I think Sundance's documentary slate really sets the agenda, and I think it's not only the most important festival for American independent film, but I think it's the most important festival for documentaries as well.
Every year when I come back from Sundance, it's the documentaries that I often remember the most. Are there any films that were selected for the U.S. Dramatic Competition that you're looking forward to seeing or that you have any insight on?
Well, the one that I'm particularly interested in, and it's probably one of the films of the festival that I'm most anxious to check out, is a movie called Blue Valentine. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. It's produced by Jamie Patrickoff, who also produced Half Nelson and Sugar. The reason I'm most interested in it is that Derek Cianfrance, who's the director, had a film at Sundance called Brother Tide. And it must have been, I don't have the exact year in front of me, but it was in the 90s. It was one of my first or second years there, mid-90s. And it has taken him a long time to get this film off the ground. Anybody who saw Brother Tide knows that he has a strong visual sense. And that film was a really well-done feature that I saw at Sundance years ago. And I've been waiting a really long time to see Derek's follow-up, and running into him along the way a number of times over the past decade as he's been trying to get this movie off the ground. And it's amazing that, you know, persistence, he's been able to stick it out, and he got the cast he needed. He got producers to help him make it happen. And now it's coming to Sundance. So I think it's going to be one of those movies that if it works, there'll be a lot to talk about there, because it's really taken him a long time to get this movie made.
Bringing it back to the Spirit Awards one last time, I was just arguing last week that Precious looks like it's losing a little steam come Oscar time, because it's sort of fading already and seems a little bit like yesterday's news. And I wondered if the Spirit Awards in particular, whether they sort of enjoy the idea of sort of launching a movie towards the Oscars, or whether they try to resist that and say, you know what, Jeff Bridges looks like he's going to get an Oscar nomination, Precious is already being touted, we're going to go in a different direction. Do you get that feeling where they don't want to be sort of a precursor to the Oscars, like the Golden Globes, but strike their own path?
I think it really depends, because there are the Spirit Awards nominations are created by separate committees, and I've served on the documentary committee for a number of years. And in our case, I know that in the years that I served on the committee, we always really tried, and we talked about this, we always tried to try not to factor in whether a film was getting recognized by other organizations, whether it wasn't, whether people were talking about it in that regard.
I meant more for the final voting, you know, now that the nominations are out, whether people who vote actual, you know, for the final winner, whether they go, you know, whether they don't want to be seen that way as sort of leaning towards whatever the big awards are.
It's a fair question. It brings up the point I made earlier, which is that, you know, the films that have the higher profile tend to be the ones that win. You know, the membership of the IFP, which is thousands of mostly independent filmmakers and folks who are really into independent film, are the ones who are generally voting. To the extent that they're, you know, factoring in what's happening with the Oscars is tough to say, because they aren't really marketed to in the same way that, you know, folks are taking out For Your Consideration ads targeting Academy voters. You don't really see folks taking out For Your Consideration ads targeting, you know, Spirit Award voters in that specific way. So I tend to think that if you have a film that is high profile, that's doing well at the box office, or at least has a fair amount of attention, I think your point about Precious is very well taken. I think that can work for or against you in a much more specific way. Just having that awareness, whether it works or not, is sort of the big question. But it's certainly something that we're always wondering with that, with the spirits, you know.
Well, certainly we appreciate you taking the time out to speak with us, not only about the Spirit Awards, but also about Sundance. Hopefully we'll talk to you in January, either during or just after the festival.
Looking forward to it.
If you want to find out what all of the Spirit Award nominations are, you can visit IndieWire.com, and there are several lists there, not only for the Spirit Awards, but also for all of the Sundance Film Festival official entries, whether they are in competition or in the premiere section or the documentary section. You can find them all at IndieWire.com. You can also follow Eugene on Twitter. His username is EUG. Eugene, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Yeah, bye.
Well, that was nice of Eugene to talk to us about the Independent Spirit Awards.
Yeah, I mean, he is somebody I have known for years and have admired and respected for years. He's incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-respected within the industry, and I'm really glad that we were able to get him on the podcast before the end of the year.
Do you admire and respect Karen and me?
Well, yeah. So much so that I talk to you every week. In fact, I respect you so much that I want to know your opinion on some of the top entertainment news stories of this week and whether they are a big deal or whether anybody should care about them, i.e. big deal or big whoop. We should probably start out this week with a little news story that kind of blew up, started in big deal or big whoop, went into the television category, but now it's back in big deal or big whoop just because I'm tired of talking about it, really.
It's fading.
It's fading. ABC dropped Adam Lambert from the Jimmy Kimmel Live talk show and their New Year's Eve concert. Now, remember, the American Music Awards, which was the event that this whole Adam Lambert sex-filled performance first appeared on, was on ABC. So now ABC is dropping Lambert from some of its shows, at least his performances. He will be on a Barbara Walters special. I believe that is airing sometime soon,
Wednesday.
December 9th. Yeah, Wednesday.
And Fox has added him to the season finale of So You Think You Can Dance on December 16th.
Because he hasn't been on enough talent reality shows.
Right.
Apparently, this all stems from some FCC complaints that were filed by the Liberty Council, which is actually tied They are tied to the late Reverend Jerry Falwell. And what I love about this particular complaint is that it was filed with ABC and with the FCC saying that ABC should have to pay a fine, but that they were then asked about Janet Jackson's performance, Lady Gaga's performance, which came much earlier in the evening on the AMA Awards, and their representative for this organization just was silent, didn't have anything to say. Oh, I didn't really see that. Sorry.
Oh.
I can only talk about... He said, no, it has nothing to do with the fact that Adam Lambert is gay. It's all about his performance. And, you know, it met the threshold for violation of federal law and a violation of FCC regulations. And the Supreme Court has held time and again that there's not a First Amendment right to engage in public indecency as evidenced by the outcry and complaints that poured into ABC. Yeah, 1,500 complaints, I might add. We believe that this violated contemporary community standards in terms of what is and what is not decent.
This is, to me, starting to become a big whoop again. I mean, a big deal again, because I think that I do think there's a double standard. I do think this had everything to do with the fact that he was gay, and I think they're using the FCC rules as an excuse, and that really irritates me.
I think it's a big whoop because these people file the complaints about TV shows all the time, and they, you know, it's organized complaints. They get mailing lists, they send it out, and they get everybody to send in the same generic email complaining about some show that they probably didn't even watch, honestly. And when you look into it and talk to the people, they actually didn't even watch the American Music Awards. And so it's a big whoop. And I've always argued that they should have a base standard before the FCC considers complaints. They should insist that 0.5% of the total viewers need to complain about a show before they are able to take any action whatsoever to look into a complaint. You know, if one half of 1%.
That's why I think this is a big deal again.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with like what he did or didn't do. That to me, I don't care.
All the time. They do these FCC complaints every week. They like to just get attention.
Moving on, we should talk about Alec Baldwin because he's going to be quitting acting after his contract for 30 Rock ends, or so he says. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, snooze. Wake me when it's over. So not a big deal. Big whoop.
Michael? I say it's a big deal because he's, you know, at the top of his game in popularity. He's got a big Christmas movie and he's winning Emmys. So if he actually sticks to it, which I doubt.
He's not going to. That's why this is not, this is a non-story.
He told Men's Journal, "I don't have any interest in acting anymore. I'm not young, but I have time to do something else." And he said,
Politics.
He considers, quote, "my entire movie career a complete failure. I'll tell you why. The goal of movie making is to star in a film where your performance drives the film. And the film is either a soaring critical or commercial success. And I never had that."
He's absolutely right, which is pretty interesting of him to be able to see that. But he never did have a good film career, even though he's a good actor.
He is a good actor.
See, to me, if he had said, "I'm going to get into politics," that would have been a big story. But since he says, I'll quit acting, I'm like, I don't care.
Okay, so we go back to music for just a second here. Billboard was incredibly lame in covering the Grammy nominations, according to Michael Giltz, who said...
Is that your editorializing there, Michael?
Yes, I believe so. He said that Billboard magazine, on their website, as of 10/22, only featured an advance about the Grammy concert nominations, not anything about them, no lists, no nothing. But they did have some lovely information about Susan Boyle, which had been a huge story earlier in the week. The New York Times, on the other hand, live blogged the concert event with links immediately to the complete list of nominees. I also noticed that when you went to the Grammy Awards site right after the concert, it was down. So I guess they kind of got inundated, as they do every year. What do you think? Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
I'm going to agree with Michael with what he editorialized here. This is a big deal. Somebody should get fired. That's a big screw up.
It is pathetic. It's a big deal. Maybe they're trying to give Lachlan something to do when he shows up. But I mean,
yeah,
come on.
I love that.
You're not live blogging the award show. You're not posting the nominations right away. And it wasn't even the big story when you went. Susan Boyle was still the top story, even when they finally, half an hour late, started to list the nominations. It still wasn't that you had to find it down below. It was pathetic.
That's really lazy. That's 1990s journalism.
Exactly. It's inexcusable.
We should tell our listeners that your reference to Lachlan was a reference to Lachlan Murdoch, who we discussed last week as the potential buyer of Nielsen Business Media, which owns Billboard magazine. But to me, this is a classic example of how Nielsen Business Media and other companies like that, their trade media outlets, they just don't get it. They do not understand how to leverage their position in traditional media into the internet. And
right, they're trapped in the 90s.
Correct. Moving on. It turns out, according to The Hollywood Reporter, that Entourage is going to be turned into a movie, possibly.
Well, I found this. For whatever reason, it really sort of struck my fancy. Mark Wahlberg, who also functions as the producer of Entourage, has said that it looks like there will be two more seasons and then they'll finish it with a movie. And I just thought that was sort of an interesting idea to end this show.
So it's a big deal. Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big whoop. The 2 million people who watch the show can now watch it on the big screen. But it makes sense as far as the show. So it's a good way to plan it and end it out. But big whoop. I haven't enjoyed the show in years.
Our next story is on a topic that is close and dear to Michael's heart. A sleazy press junket is being held, or was held, for the DVD release of The Hangover. The studio, Warner Brothers in this case, is flying everyone to Las Vegas for a red carpet gala event where they will have, I don't know who they're bringing, but apparently none of the stars are actually going to be there. Swag for journalists who want to cover the DVD release of the movie, and Gawker jokes repeatedly about how a free trip to Vegas surely won't affect anyone's coverage of the title's release. Michael, is this a big deal? I'm almost afraid to ask.
It's a big deal. It's like now great. The sleazy journalism has extended to DVDs where I work, so I couldn't be happier.
No,
it's Friday, December. It's this Friday, December. It's Thursday, December 10th, by the way, so it's just happening this week.
Are you going to be going?
No, I wasn't invited. I should have been. I'm at Right for Huffington. I review DVDs for Huffington. Maybe I was invited and ignored it. I'll have to look through my emails, but I don't think I was.
I think the bigger deal here is that they're making such a big deal out of a DVD release. Come on, really?
Well, that's a growing trend. You make more money on DVD than you do in the film, or at least just as much. And they're very right to keep to promote it. They want to build on the film's advertising, and they want to create a little new hoopla to create awareness for it. And they've had DVD premieres and DVD, where they show it in a theater again and get the stars there. It's a very natural thing. It makes, if this movie is going to make $100 million on DVD in the U.S., I'm sure, at least. So there's every reason to promote it and make a big deal out of it.
I don't know. Seems something inherently unsexy about a DVD release.
There's nothing unsexy about an extra $100 million in the till.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show, where we always discuss a little inside baseball, stories that really only people in Hollywood or in the industry would care about. But this week, we actually have a story that technically could have led off our show, because it's a story that everyone seems to care about. It's the merger or acquisition of NBC Universal by Comcast, one of the world's largest cable networks, or cable, it's not a network, it's really a cable company.
Yeah.
On Thursday, they announced officially that Comcast Corp would be buying control of NBC Universal from General Electric Company. They will be buying 51% of the company for
$30 billion transaction.
Yeah, well, it values the company at $30 billion, but they will provide $6.5 billion in cash. 51% ownership of the new entity will be given to Comcast. For GE, it's the end of an era. I mean, they owned NBC for 25 years. Universal lately has switched back and forth between one company and another, but NBC was owned by GE for over two decades.
Yeah.
Now, the big issue here is that it shows a couple of things. One, that the cable channels are actually, and cable networks, are more profitable than traditional networks. And that's kind of important. The chief operating officer, Steve Burke, told analysts in a conference call that cable channels are the best part of the media business today. They are really the crown jewels of any entertainment company. It was such a big deal that the company town column in the Los Angeles Times had not one, but two columns on Friday, one by Claudia Eller, and one by Meg James. There was another column as well, Joe Flint, talking about how the deal raises some antitrust concerns, which is really what I wanted to talk about.
By all means, start there. I didn't consider that.
When you think about it, in 1948, the United States sued Paramount Pictures, and it was known as the Hollywood antitrust case of 1948. And what it did was it made all of the Hollywood studios, who up until then had all of the actors and directors and writers under contract, they also owned, in 1948, 17% of the theaters in the United States, which accounted for 45% of the film rental revenue. They also practiced something called block booking and blind buying, and that was all ended by this case in 1948. It's a landmark Supreme Court decision that is always turned to when it comes to vertical integration and antitrust rulings, because it made the studios, which were feeding their own theaters their own content and forcing them to take it and sometimes selling it to the theaters before it was even made, which is how they financed the films, it ended all of that. It is considered the beginning of the death of the Hollywood system. So that is why Universal or Sony Pictures or Warner Brothers, they don't own movie theaters, nor can they. They would not be allowed to, because then they would own the ability to produce and to distribute, which they do now, as well as sell all of their content. So they would be vertically integrated. It's a very efficient scheme, but not allowed in this country, in the United States. Well, the same is true of this deal with Comcast and NBC Universal. In fact, Joe Flint points out in the LA Times, Comcast and NBC Universal are not head-to-head competitors, and their merger does not trigger significant antitrust issues. Nevertheless, the combined company represents complementary businesses joining forces to create a vertically integrated juggernaut that represents a formidable video gateway reaching consumers over the air, through cable, and on the internet. Comcast NBC actually accounts for 20% of all the viewing hours in the United States, which I thought was a fascinating figure. And you guys can stop me at any time, by the way, because
no,
I'm just going to go on and on and on about this, because I think it's fascinating that they're allowing this to happen in broadcast, because it's an industry under threat, but they would never allow this to happen if Sony wanted to go out and buy AMC theaters, which is a big chain here in the United States.
I guess I just never saw it that way. I saw Jeffrey Zucker, who is whatever the hell his title is at NBC, chairman,
I believe,
talking about this on, I think, CNN, and he was focusing primarily on content and how now their content's got all these different methods of distribution, and I was focusing more on that when I look at this merger, and I never considered the antitrust.
Yeah, they're the largest provider of broadband internet services, and so why do you think they're doing this?
Yeah.
Hulu, you think Hulu's going to be free once Comcast takes over?
No.
Yeah, that's precisely.
When Time Warner and AOL got married, everyone thought that this was the second coming, and it was just
exactly
such a nightmare, you know, because the two different companies, the different types of companies that they are, just don't really speak the same language. So I'm curious to know what the fallout is going to be from this, whether they've learned.
Well, here's where NBC Universal makes its money today, and we should talk a little bit about why Comcast is so interested. $5.8 billion is made from Universal Pictures, Working Title, Focus Features, Universal Studios, and Universal Studios Florida. So that's kind of their film and parks. The Cable and Entertainment Group makes $5.5 billion. That includes USA Network, Bravo, Sci-Fi, or SIFI, whatever we want to call it these days.
We call it Sci-Fi.
Oxygen, Style, E. They have a whole bunch of regional sports networks and Versus and the Golf Channel. And then they also have, of course, the NBC network and the Universal Media Studios. So that's all of their broadcast and cable entertainment. They also, and so the broadcast alone, NBC network, $4.2 billion. Local stations bring in $1.9 billion. And those local stations are here in Los Angeles and in New York and in Chicago. Those are the NBC affiliates in those markets. Cable news brings in $1.2 billion, and that comes in through MSNBC, CNBC, and CNBC World. And then $594 million comes in through the Telemundo Network, which is 16 TV stations, including KVEA, Channel 52 in Los Angeles, and WNJU in New York. And so really, it's a play to start controlling some of the content that gets shoved through their pipes, because otherwise they are just going to be dumb pipes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the topics we've discussed previously, that idea of theatrical release windows, are among the changes that Comcast will be weighing for Universal in the future. And in fact, Burke, the Comcast COO, said clearly there is the ability to create new video-on-demand packages to move windows. He said there are a lot of opportunities out there. Obviously, not all of them are going to work.
It's a fascinating topic.
It is a fascinating topic.
But it will be approved.
Yes, probably in 12 to 18 months, we'll all be calling it Comcast NBC Universal. Well, that concludes our show. As always, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us, 888-567-SAND or 888-567-7263. You can look up the show notes for any of our shows with links to all of the stories we discussed on today's show. Look up the notes on showbizsandbox.com. They will be found in the notes for episode 32. Michael Giltz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael can be found on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the name to look up. He can also be found on michaelgiltz.com. Links to all of his work is there. Karen can be found at Karen Woodward Online. And her Twitter name is heywoody3939.
That's right.
Now, I can be found on Twitter as well. My username is Sperling. And I can also be found on celluloidjunkie.com. I will also be on CNET's The Real Deal later this week with Rafe Needleman and Tom Merritt. Well, Michael, before you take off, since you're at the grocery store, can you pick up some milk?
I will.
Thank you very much. Until next week, play nice.